your own expenses. There are clauses all over the place, and none of them know how to read a contract. And most, you know, I came from the world of staff journalists and staff jobs where most of this stuff was taken care of for me. I didn't know how to read a contract not that long ago. And so I just see that as some place where we're really lacking, that we need to be teaching students skills that they're going to use in a world where most of them are going to freelance. You know, even if they end up with a staff job, they're going to end up freelancing pretty regularly. They're going to have to take care of their own health benefits. So, you know, a few tools that I use with my students that I think pretty much any good journalism professor should use with their students is, you know, I came from a photojournalism background. You can find this particular tool in a variety of places, but I use the National Press Photographers Association's version. It's free. You can find it on their website, and it's called a cost of doing business calculator. And having your students, before they graduate, go and do that so they know what a day of their time is worth and what it's going to cost them for health insurance, maintaining the equipment that they use, if they use equipment, you know, keeping their car updated, all these things. It takes you a couple hours to go through and add up all of these expenses, work it through your year. How many days a year do you want to work? Do you want to take a vacation? How many days? And just figure out what you need to get paid per day to keep yourself afloat. Because I find it really frustrating when a very talented student gets back to me and it's like, I've had some successes, I've sold some stories, I've worked here and I've worked there, but I'm broke. I'm really not doing well financially, because they're not prepared for that. And these are realities of the world that I think are much more difficult than when I went into the industry. So, you know, going over contracts with students is something that I do, and I try to share mine. Going over copyright is incredibly important, particularly if you've got students that are going to go work in social media. You know, just learning right off the bat that you can't just grab a picture because it's online and put it with your story or throw it into your publication. You know, learning the basics of copyright law, contract law, a variety of other things. And there are a variety of appropriate online tools to kind of help students prepare themselves for working in the trenches. And that kind of gets to another thing that I do. Some of my students like this. I think most actually really don't. But I really try not to. I teach a lot of multimedia journalism, but I try not to teach the hands-on stuff in class. I do a little bit of stuff like that. We have amazing resources like lynda.com and, you know, a variety of YouTube resources to teach people how to, say, edit with Premiere Pro or how to work a specific camera. And I think, you know, even though the students feel as though they want to come in and work with a professional who will tell them how to work all this equipment, that's not a very good use of either the instructor or the student's time. What I usually do is assign them lessons in online resources that will get them up to the basic level with any number of these programs, whatever they're doing, and then use our class time to show them how to apply that to journalism, you know, how to do actual nonfiction storytelling with these things. Because I found over the years that as we've gotten more complicated in the technologies that we use, that you can eat up an entire class just showing the nuts and bolts of working a computer program or working a camera and never get to the actual act of committing journalism with it. And I think that's, you know, a disservice to our students, you know, assigning homework for them to go and learn how to work the camera with an online tutorial or learn how to work the program or at least the basics, and then come in so that you can tell them this is how you use this in journalism, and ideally take them out into situations where they actually are doing journalism and making mistakes with that, I find is a more effective way to teach. Another reason for that, and I think other people have probably experienced this as well, is that the technology's changed so quickly that half the time you spend your time teaching somebody Photoshop or Lightroom, and by the time they've graduated, what you've taught them is obsolete. And so you've just taught them a skill that's not going to be that useful to them. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry, I thought I heard a voice. I kind of teach this idea of learning how to learn the technologies, not learning a specific technology or feeling that you're going to graduate being an expert with, you know, a video editing program or something like that, but learning how nonlinear editing programs work and how to think about them. That's a valuable skill that you can apply to Final Cut Pro, Premiere Pro, audio editing programs, and learn how to learn those very quickly quickly on the fly, because they're going to go into jobs where, you know, they may have learned one program, the place uses a different program, you know, rather than kind of, oh my God, I'm not prepared because I didn't learn this program. It'd be like, I know how to learn programs like this. You know, I can learn it overnight. I can learn it in a week. And then finally, you know, a couple other things that I do that I think are really helpful that have been successful to me. If I'm teaching a class like, say, science writing or my reporting on the environment class, I generally require that students, if they want an A on a story, either sell it or bring me a rejection. I really push pitching. You know, I found that a lot of my very talented students could write a great story for me and get a great grade on it, but boy, if I said, you know, you should place this somewhere, you need to sell this, they're terrified of somebody else seeing it. It's kind of this mentality of, you know, when you're writing theme papers or something like that. So, you know, I've actually found that to be very successful. I've also found that, you know, in pretty much any class that I teach like that, I have 2, 3, 4 students who actually place a story, get a paycheck out of the class. That's, you know, way better than getting an A from me on the top of a piece of paper. So, and then finally, you know, getting back to my book, one thing that I do a lot as in this kind of teaching hospital model is collaborating with my students. So sometimes I'll pitch a project and that's something that maybe I don't think I can either accomplish by myself or something that I just think would be really fun to do with a team of students. And if I can sell that to one of my old contacts in the industry, to a television station or some type of online website, then I'll split the proceeds with my students, put together a small team of 1 to 3 people. They need clips to get jobs. You know, they're not going to get a grade on this, but lots of students are motivated by even a small paycheck. And then we'll go and do the story together. So I've done some pieces for On Earth. We did some pretty well-received videos, one for On Earth, one for The Guardian on elephant poaching and the ivory crush that went on in Colorado a couple of years ago, and I've done, you know, shared bylines with stories for a variety of publications. Again, you know, I think that paychecks are more motivating often than grades are. I've also took students to Prescott, Arizona, because I cover wildfire a lot, so after the disaster there with the hot shots, while I was working on that for my book, I went down, a couple of my students did projects there, freelance pieces out of that. I found that to be really helpful for them, very trying, because you're going into a, you know, a very tragic news situation, and you know, put, you know, none of them or very few of them have dealt with anything like that before. So going into the scrum of media, watching how people work in that kind of a situation, pursuing their own work, you know, learning how to deal with sensitive topics, with tragedy, with, you know, the family members of people that have died. I think that's something that they can learn from having a professor that's got some experience with that, or from, pardon me, other media people that are out in the field. A couple of projects that we've done that we've had some success with. So we got Tom Yulsman, who's also here, the director of the center, and I got back from the Arctic last week, and we Tom had written a grant, and we collaborated on this with a university in Oslo and the Norwegian Polar Institute. So we've got a project where we take 3 of our graduate students who apply for the honor to go with us to collaborate with 3 Norwegian environmental journalism graduate students, and we took them to, I still can't say this after like 4 months, it's Ny Ålesund. It is the farthest north permanently inhabited settlement in the world on Svalbard, the island way up in the Arctic, and it's all researchers that now from around the world who've basically converted coal miners' cabins into research facilities, and you know, we could basically introduce these 2 crews of journalism students from you know, different cultures, different worlds. You got to find stories, and we're going to do both a website of our own for this, but again, we really want you guys to be pitching these stories to other outlets, and we haven't had any sales yet, but I'm pretty confident that if not on this trip, our hope is that we'll be doing this through 2020, that we're going to have sales from the ongoing work with that project. And then the last thing I was going to do is just mention one of our students who's here, a recent graduate, Gloria Dickey. She's actually running for the board of SEJ. I'm not saying you should vote for her. but she's, you know, Gloria came to us with an undergraduate degree that was journalism and communication from Canada, but wasn't really happy with the way that she learned how to do science and environment reporting. She worked really intensively with us, was a research assistant for us, interned at the Boulder Daily Camera, then National Geographic, then High Country News, and now she works for James Balog, who was the National Geographic photographer who does the extreme ice survey and has got a documentary coming out on extinction. I know James. He was able to send me a note saying, hey, you've got some really gifted students. I want to send a student to cover the COP in Paris. And A, Gloria is really talented, and I was confident that she'd be able to do the job, but she's Canadian, so it's like, hey, you speak French, don't you? And so anyway, you know, I have seen a success with certain students, you know, with the variety of techniques that I've mentioned here. I'll end by just pointing out that I have absolutely no training in academia, so probably most of these ideas as we go down the line here will be refuted, and I would absolutely trust everybody else on this panel more than me. So thanks for listening.
Okay, I'm going to do something that they always say is really dangerous for a moderator to do, and I'm going to immediately entertain a couple of questions before we move on to the next speaker.
Bernard Waka from the University of South Florida. First, Michael, I agree with everything you said that you do in your classes. I think it's a really good way to approach your classes. I just have a question about how much support you get from the university to do the Norway project, to send students to cover COP. How do you arrange those things?
Support from the university directly. I'll say that actually we probably didn't get really any true support from the university. They're very excited that we did this. They just put one of the students up in the Arctic making video on a glacier as the cover of the newsletter for our new college, so they're excited that we did it. But yeah, most of the money came through the Norwegian University and the Norwegian Polar Institute financially. As far as other types of support, you know, I am traveling a lot for personal work or for work for the university, which means I have to, I owe a lot of colleagues either beers or classes covered, because, you know, I had to get, I think, 3 classes covered for that. I've got another trip going elsewhere in November that I'm going to have to get 4 classes covered, and so that proves to be challenging, because on one hand, I'm presenting an opportunity to one group of students, and on another hand, I feel like I'm actually deserving some other students who are going to be sitting in class expecting me to be there. So one thing that I have done, and I got some great support from the National Science Foundation, is the November trip is to Antarctica. This came up fairly short notice, and I'll be away for 3 weeks. But I was able to arrange to be able to do a class via Skype from McMurdo Station. And so that's something that I can actually bring the university into, because, you know, it's a class of 20 students that I'll be speaking to. But it dawns on me, boy, that is really kind of unfair for the federal government to be providing this to me, and I'm only going to teach 20 students, so why don't I send this around and say, okay, look, we can have a bunch of classes here. My students get to ask the first question, but, you know, why don't we fill the room? Because, you know, this is a good opportunity. And so I think things like that have made the university a lot more interested in the CEJ, and the CEJ itself, the Center for Environmental Journalism, has actually been getting a lot of support and interest from the university. We're in an unusual situation in that for those of you who are unfamiliar, our journalism program at Colorado was closed several years ago. It was painful and controversial, but the journalism department still existed. We still had all the classes. And amid all of that, they decided that actually that was a big mistake. For one thing, they probably would have lost the Center for Environmental Journalism, because our funders want us to be a part of a journalism school or a college. So they created a new college, and our new college is much broader. So it's got what you would expect, you know, it's the College of Media and Communication and Information. It's got journalism, it's got communication, it's got media, but it's also got things like information science, which has a team that works on using social media for disaster response. So now we're using social media with them for disaster response for journalism and working on some projects with them. We've got, you know, critical media practices, which is an academic jargon name for basically nonfiction documentary film, and we've got collaborations with them. So I find that things like that are ways that we really bring in support, is finding really great collaborators in the university, and that the university is helpful and supportive on campus of us with that, but for the big projects that we get that come our way, we generally have to kind of make that happen for ourselves, and then when that happens, the university is happy to cheer for us.
Hey, another question, yes?
David Slyper, UC Davis, at College of Biological Sciences.
Uh-huh.
I like what you said about pitching, and I was wondering if you could speak a little bit high-level strategy for just what students should be looking for in their articulating value or pitching a story.
So I actually, in all my graduate classes and in some of my undergraduate classes, I actually will have an assignment for them to learn how to pitch, and there are great resources for that. So I use, particularly because we're focused on the environment, the pitching chapter from the Science Writer's Handbook, which you guys have seen. There's a new edition or a new version of this that is the Science Writing Essay Handbook by Michelle Nyhaus, but she was involved in this first Science Writer's Handbook. It's actually a great book. I actually find it really helpful to teach out of that, and there's a really good pitching chapter in that. There's also great pitching resource at the Open Notebook, which is a pitch database. And so part of the assignment is they go through the pitch database, and you can use that. You can search by publication or by writer. So if you've got a publication that you're interested in or a writer that you like, then you can read their actual pitches and then see the final story that came out of it. So that's a great way to teach it, too. So the main thing is, getting them this idea of pitch, which is both something to show that you've got the chops to do the story and you can write well, but it's also a business document. How long is the story going to be, et cetera. So, getting them down to the basics of that, and then they actually have to write a pitch for a grade. Sometimes those are pitches that I expect them to send in. More often than not, they're not, only because they haven't made it to the point in the class where they've got a story they're working on that they're comfortable pitching yet or ready to pitch. But then when I have the projects, they have to write a pitch for that and either sell it, which happens sometimes, but obviously not that often, or bring me a rejection.
Okay, good. Let's hold those questions for just a minute, and we'll move on to Mark Neusel. Mark?
Thank you.
Tell us about your book.
Excuse me. you can talk to me later about that if you want. That's fine. I'm gonna share a few things with you. I'm trying to approach this from what I would like to know if I was sitting in your seat, and if I was either new at this or relatively new, or perhaps an adjunct with a full-time gig somewhere else, and what are the things that would be the most helpful from that perspective. So that's how I'm going to approach it. So I think what I'll do is I'm going to give you four assignments that have worked for me over the years, and I've been doing this for 23 years, and one teaching philosophy that our university subscribes to, and then talk to you briefly about our learning lab. And I'll echo what Michael said about lynda.com. We use lynda.com extensively for the technical training, I guess you'd say, that we then don't need to do in class. We do very little of that in class anymore because of that online resource and others. So I would also put in a plug for that. And in fact, I go use that too when I get stuck. Had that happen last Saturday on a field shoot with a new camera. But anyway, let me share the assignments with you, and you can adapt these as you see fit or reject them. Preface this by saying who my students are to make sure they sort of match up with what kind of audience you might have. We have two sorts of students. We have the strictly environmental journalism students, the students who are learning to be reporters and editors and videographers and so on. And then we have a second group of students who are interested in strategic communication. And so they will be interested in advertising and public relations primarily, but strategic communications in particular. And so I offer a course that is called Environmental Communications that meets the needs of those students, as well as I hope helps the journalism students do their jobs better. And for the strategic communication students, it becomes a little trickier because they're going to go on to careers where they're going to probably work for NGOs or perhaps the state government or nonprofits in the area and so on. And they're going to do communication work but not really what we consider to be journalism. So the assignments have to be tailored a little bit differently for those students, or you have to have additional assignments for those students in this particular class that I'm speaking of, the environmental communication class, which has a fairly broad audience. And some of you may have experienced this as well, that we now have at our university, St. Thomas is in St. Paul, Minnesota, we have about 10,000 students, we have 6,500 undergrads, and probably about 400 or 450 communication and journalism majors. So it's a medium-sized college. But we are seeing increasing numbers in my classes of students from biology and the natural sciences in the class. The science faculty in particular wants their biology students to take a writing class. They want, and they come to me for that because it seems like a natural fit for them. So some semesters, the demand far exceeds the supply. And we're going to experiment this year with teaching the course as a one-month J-term course just to satisfy some of the demand, so a very intensive four-week course in January in Minnesota, 3 hours a day, 4 days a week. And we'll see. I'll let you know how that goes. Well, that brings me to my first assignment. Thanks for that transition, Randy. So the very first assignment we do, of course, is a nature walk. And it gets the students excited about the class within the first couple of weeks or so, and it gets them outside. Now, we have a very urban campus. It's in the middle of St. Paul, Minnesota. There's a campus in Minneapolis. It's extremely urban, but we have the advantage of our campus bordering the Mississippi River, right up next to it. And so, there are many both formal trails established by the Park District and the National Park that flows through the Mississippi in our cities, but there's also animal trails. There's footpaths that have been worn down by high school students drinking beer down there over the years, that sort of thing. And so in the early part of the class, I tell everybody, dress for it, bring some water, bring a hat, off we go. So the setup to the assignment is they have to read some good nature writing. I always assign John Burroughs, sometimes Sigurd Olson, sometimes Thoreau, sometimes, if I'm crazy, other writers as well. But they have to read a little bit of that. They have to understand the value of what Burroughs called the ramble, which is just essentially walking in the backyard and writing about what you see. And off we go. Now, I always warn the students, don't wear white shoes and don't wear white pants, because we go off the path. And I had a young woman one time who showed up in brand new white Nikes and white pants, and she hit the mud at the top of the slide, and by the time she ended up down by the river, they weren't white anymore. And I've also had one other thing, that it's a very steep gorge, by the way, the Mississippi River in St. Paul, and I encountered this now twice and was unprepared for it the first time. I was prepared for it the second time, and that is a student very afraid of heights. Never even occurred to me. And I had a poor student who we got to the top of the gorge and we're about to descend, and she just was frozen. And so I had to assign another student to sit with her while we went. Now, the second time, so I asked them beforehand, come up, see me privately, you got a problem with this, and we'll take care of it. Because it's 400 feet straight down in some spots, and that can be worrisome to some people. So it happened last week again. But what I did was I got another instructor to come along and be at the end of the line of the students and to stay with her at the top. So she didn't have to sit by herself. And he was kind enough to do that. So that worked out okay. But the assignment itself is fairly straightforward. As we go down through these animal trails and whatnot, students have to identify at least one thing that they come back and research and write about. And I give them a three-part assignment in terms of observation, description, and research. And they pick, it could be a bird that we see, it could be an animal it could be animal scat, it could be a plant, it could be an invasive species, it could be fish, it could be anything. And of course, in a wildlife-rich area like the Mississippi River, there's going to be plenty of stuff to see, especially during the migration season for the birds. And so a lot of the students could not tell a cardinal from a robin, so there's a lot of that's a cardinal, that's not. that kind of stuff goes on. They all have to bring a camera. And for all of our assignments, we require the students not only to write text, but to supply a digital image with it as well, just for practice. And I'm sure Michael's heard this a million times, but I say it to the students every single semester, the best camera you own is the one in your pocket. Because they all freak out about it. I don't have an Nikon. You know, they all go through all that stuff. And I say, no, you have a phone, so you have a camera. Bring it. And they do. And they know how to use it, of course. So the nature walk assignment gets them excited about the class and gets them going and gets them outside. And then they actually have to do some research and writing about a particular topic. And that assignment, other than the fear of heights thing and the white clothing thing, has worked pretty well over the years. So with those two caveats, I would offer that one as a pretty good one. I'm not going to tell you about all the failures, by the way. You know, 80% of the assignments that I've tried that have just fallen flat, but we can have a conversation at the bar about those later. The second thing we do, and we do this on a rotating basis, I've created a wiki, a class wiki, and you can do this through Wikipedia, one of the Wikipedia sites. There's many, many softwares that support this kind of idea. The problem is coming up with a good topic to support an ongoing wiki. And the topic that I have chosen that has worked out okay, I would say it has its moments, is urban agriculture. Because we're in the middle of right in the middle of town, heavy urban area, but there is a somewhat of a food movement in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and it does lend itself to stories like that. So the students have to contribute an entry to the wiki. And that entry is approved by me beforehand. It has to have scientific sourcing. The usual standards apply. And it has to relate to urban agriculture in some way. In this way, we've done a couple of things. You can then extend it from semester to semester to semester and build on it and actually create something of value. And as soon as I get about one more semester in it, I'm going to post it for the general public to read. I need some more content before we do that. The second thing we do is one of the biologists got very excited about this, and we actually taught a joint course, conservation biology and environmental journalism, in which both sets of students contributed to the wiki. And the journalism students edited the materials from the conservation biology students, and the conservation biology students edited the science in the journalism students' entries. And that one seemed to work out pretty well as well. And they got to see new students, and that was kind of exciting and broke up the class a little bit. So I hope to have that up in the next semester or so. I'm waiting for kind of a critical mass of, I don't want it to be too thin and look amateurish, even though it is thin and amateurish. The third one I wanted to mention real quickly was we partnered with the state of Minnesota this past spring. Our state, like your state, I'm sure, has a state DNR publication, a magazine. Some of them are spectacular, some of them not so. You know, we think of Arizona Highways. We think of all these state magazines that showcase wildlife and outdoors in the state. In Minnesota, it's called the Minnesota Conservation Volunteer, and it's 6 times a year magazine. So I contacted the Minnesota Conservation Volunteer, and we arranged a critique of their magazine from the journalism students and the communication students in terms of advertising, PR, and the students who are interested in graphic design. And what they did was that we contracted with the state to allow us to give them a formal appraisal of the magazine, including a written appraisal as well as a focus group. And the state, of course, loved it because, like most states and like most publications, their average age of their reader is 52 years old, and it's getting older. And they do a crappy job online and a terrible job in social media, and they don't know what to do about it because the editors are even older than me. And they produce magnificent content for a printed publication. It's just wonderful. And it's extremely popular in the state, but their audience is dying. And so their challenge is to get the 18 to 22-year-olds in, and that's what we tried to do. So you might be able to make that effort in your state if you've got a state government agency that's amenable to that. That was among the most valuable assignments I've ever had, both on both sides. The students actually had to think about something more than just the content that they themselves produce. I mean, they're actually assessing other content and who the audience might be and which stories did they read and which stories did they skip and which stories did they talk about among their friends and all those kinds of things. And then what kinds of social media strategies should this magazine have given the age of their audience? And it took a while, and it was a lot of work, but it was very beneficial for both sides, very beneficial for both sides. So I would recommend that as a possibility. I got third one is, the fourth one. Let me just say then two other things. Our university, like yours, has a writing across the curriculum program that has been very helpful for the students to do both low, medium, and high intensity writing, as it's called, and I can speak to you about that later. And then we have the Student Media Lab, which is called TommyMedia.com. It is an all digital publication. Students are all paid. We don't have a printed paper anymore. We haven't since 2009. And the students are encouraged out of class, the best one to go work for, TommyMedia.com, and get their work published.
Okay, good. Time for two quick questions and two quicker answers.
Mark, I'm wondering how do you prepare your students to do this evaluation of this?
We had the editor and the managing editor and the art director come in and set it up by giving a background of the magazine. And they provided us with their audience research data. So we've got everything from Google Analytics that they supplied to previous consulting work that they had done, and students got to read all that and then talk to the people themselves.
Wow, what a great assignment. Anybody else? Bruno.
Mark.
Hi, Bruno.
I really interested in this collaboration with the conservation biology students.
Yeah.
So how did that happen? Because I'm trying to do it, but it's hard to find that other instructor, and somehow the logistics of making it work.
We had to do it far ahead of time because once I identified an instructor who was interested in, and he had worked at one of the Sea Grant stations in Duluth, Minnesota, so I knew he knew the local ecosystem pretty well. Once I identified that person, I went to him. He liked the idea, but we needed about a year and a half to schedule it to make sure our courses met at the same time, and that was the tricky part. So his lab had to meet at the same time as mine did. And once we got through that logistical part, it wasn't too bad.
Okay.
Short enough, Dave.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Thanks.
Great. Just time enough to squeeze Don in here. No, we got lots of time.
Okay.
Take it away.
Thanks for squeezing me in. It's the title of this program is Preparing Students for an Evolving Profession, but I find that what really goes on for me is my students are preparing me for an evolving profession. I learn a lot from my students, and they're way ahead of me on a lot of different areas of social media. One of the biggest things that I've seen change in our program, and it kind of echoes what Mark says, is that we have to hustle for students. And 10, 15 years ago, in my environmental journalism and communication classes, it was primarily journalists who were inspired by reading things about Three Mile Island or the Exxon Valdez, or they read something about Times Beach in St. Louis, where I work, Webster University's in St. Louis, and the dioxin crisis that hit Times Beach. But those students are in smaller numbers, so you really can't depend in a small program just on journalism students. So Mark was nice enough to call those public relations students strategic communication students, but I'm an old-time journalist who still calls them PR people, you know, PR guys. And there's a little bit of suspicion among the journalism students, why are these PR people in this class? And then another added element to that is the sustainability group from the liberal arts, because I've sort of had to expand, you know, the rubric for who we take in and who becomes part of this class by including not only public relations students, but also encouraging students who come out of the growing liberal arts program where the sustainability studies is housed at our university. So I get a pretty strange mix of people, but it's interesting to watch them kind of collide with each other and see where they have some commonalities. Now, the journalists I think we've had some success getting them a few newspaper jobs, newsletter jobs in the environment, but I think they're surprised to see more internships and more job opportunities for those strategic communication students. And in St. Louis, we do, that's one of the, you know, advantages of being in an urban area is we have a lot of internships with different groups, and so the journalists are kind of limited because it's the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or a couple of weekly newspapers, maybe magazines. But the public relations students, the strategic communication students, they have TrailNet, Green Dining Alliance, Missouri Coalition for the Environment, Sierra Club. They have so many more options where they're going to be doing more kinds of advocacy journalism or advocacy kind of work. And then there's the sustainability students, and they're a whole different ballgame. A number of them can't write, so we have some difficulties there. But they have lots of enthusiasm, and I'd say half of them are into urban farming, and the rest of them are into biking, solar, or wind power. So it's a strange mix, and it's a challenge being a professor, having to work with all three of these and get that to somehow meld. At the same time, though, it's not impossible, and it's a great way to sort of contrast different kinds of communications and show them the difference. And it's enlightening for the public relations students to see this kind of old-time, traditional, you know, I don't want to say objectivity, I don't want to say he said, she said, but that's kind of what that's about to some extent. And it's enlightening for the journalism students to see that your public relations people are not your enemies. And I try to bring in people from all of those different areas to guest speak every Friday because I'm pretty exhausted by Friday. So I do try to bring in different people. And I'm somewhat limited with the journalism because we have like a couple of environmental beat reporters at the Post-Dispatch, and they're so damn busy they can, you know, it's really hard for them to make time because they've got so much to cover. So I do end up bringing in more people from the strategic communications area, whether it's with all the environmental groups or, and then the sustainability students are a whole different ballgame, but there's plenty of people to invite there from the solar industry and the wind industry and the urban farming areas in St. Louis. So the journalists start to sort of feel a little left out by the end. They're a little surprised and to some extent overwhelmed the same way I was when these changes started happening. I'm somebody who resisted the whole sustainability movement, and when the faculty in liberal arts moved to turn the environmental faculty committee into the sustainability studies committee, I resisted it because I thought, well, this is sort of like greenwashing to me. We're not going to do investigative reporting anymore. We're going to write about urban farming. And so I sort of resisted that. I've since changed my mind so much that I even included sustainability in my book. I don't know if I did. I mentioned I have a book, too. So
let's ask about that.
So I did. I included a chapter on sustainability, and I'm a believer to some extent, but it's also I have to be a believer just out of survival because I have to bring in all these different students in. And at universities these days, they're requiring a minimum number of students, and they bring down the axe. You have to beg and plead if you're below 10 in classes. So that's another reason why I have to bring in students from these other areas. Students, by and large, want some place to have an outlet for their work. The student newspaper at my university is still the more traditional journalists, so they sort of like sneer and look down their nose. We have a sustainability conference at Webster University every year. It's coming up in a couple weeks, and I can't talk them into covering it. They just are not interested in it. They just think that it's kind of soft. We're going to do the Three Mile Island stuff. We don't know what that urban farming stuff is. We're not going to have any of that. So I've had to give them another outlet. So the outlet that we've created is environmentalecho.com, which is a pretty basic WordPress blog, but it's been a lot of fun to see the different stories that, you know, these different constituencies within the class come up with. And it's also, I think, sort of enlightening to the students to see what are the top posts. Where's the traffic going? And sort of, you know, to the little bit of the chagrin of the journalism students, it's not always the hard news kinds of stories that are attracting attention. But I also think that gives them a lesson on how to maybe shape stories that they do, or to look at the way they should frame stories in order to get people under the tent to look at what's going on. So I brought along the latest top 10 posts that we've had. And so the first one was on Merrimack Caverns, where Jesse James hung out in Missouri. And that's been shut down for half the summer because of a TCE leak from an environmental hazard site about 30 miles away. And people were going, well, why are so many people hitting on this particular story? I said, well, it's a top tourism area. A lot of people can relate to it. Not everybody can relate to some of the bigger stories in St. Louis because they're more confined. If you know St. Louis, one of the great things about us, too, is that we have environmental disasters from A to Z. There's no shortage of things that they can cover. And one of the big ones, and in fact, SEJ came to St. Louis back in the 90s because of the amount of radioactive contamination we have in the area from when Mallinckrodt was refining uranium for the atomic bomb program. Well, that radioactivity, you'll be glad to know, hasn't disappeared since you were there in the 90s. It's still in North County and the Coldwater Creek area. But we also have a site that's next to what's called the Bridgeton Landfill. And I don't know if you've read about this, but the Bridgeton Landfill has been on fire for about 3 years now. And the fire is getting closer and closer to where the radioactive waste landfill is. And so all the different federal constituencies are kind of like throwing this hot potato back and forth on, literally a hot potato, on who's going to handle this and who's going to remediate it. That's a great story, and that is our number two story on the site, but I think some people in the class thought that should be number one, and that's where most of the attention should go. The third story that's attracted the most hits is one which is based on the book Black Faces, White Spaces, and it's all about how black folks are a little more reluctant to go into the outdoors and what are some of the reasons why they don't want to go into the outdoors. I'll go through these quickly. Another one that really hacks off the journalism students, and this is one of the top posts, Santa Claus Blasts Global Warming. And it was just a fun piece about Santa Claus talking about how, you know, he didn't know how he was going to get the sleigh launched because the permafrost was melting. And the journalism students, again, sneered at that piece, but it actually brought in numbers. And I think in some ways it teaches them a little lesson that maybe you need to lighten up or maybe reformat your stories. Think about what's attracting interest. Fifth was, and this is not a surprise, the growing craft brewing industry keeps its eyes on sustainability. There's that word, sustainability. I don't know how many students come to me and want to write about beer. And I have to say, well, there's a really loose connection to the environment, but maybe I'm mistaken, so go ahead and run with it. So that's one thing I have to give as a caveat a lot. Well, maybe I'm mistaken, though, so run with it and see what you come up with. The Westlake landfill issue comes in sixth, and that's the landfill that has the radioactive contamination left over from. I know that SEJ called St. Louis Atomic City when it came in the 90s. St. Louis is still very much Atomic City, and there's so many stories that can come out of that. One of the most interesting things about both the Westlake landfill and also Coldwater Creek to me is the fact that the activists who are involved with these stories are all females. They're all mothers. And that's another thing that the students ask, well, why aren't there men involved with this? Why? And so we have a pretty good discussion about why women are activists. Why is it on their radar and why isn't it on more men's radar? It's interesting, too, to see the different activist groups that have kind of coalesced around their issue. This is a story that's gotten a lot of hits, and we actually scooped the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on some of these stories, and that was, we had I think it was more like a 500-year flood back in the end of December, where we had an 8-inch rain blast come through St. Louis, and for a time, there were very few ways out of St. Louis because the major bridges, except for the ones over the Mississippi, were flooded out. And one of the things that happened is two sewage plants which had bunkers around them, went underwater, and then they've been leaking sewage periodically into the Merrimack River. One plant leaked for 4 months straight into the Merrimack River. That's attracted a lot of attention. Where we scooped the Post-Dispatch was one of the reasons why some people speculate this happened is because the Corps of Engineers built this giant levee around Valley Park, which is a community down in that floodplain. What that did is exacerbate the water for all the other communities downstream, like Fenton, Sunset Hills. In doing an investigation on that, in cooperation with a couple of different environmental organizations, it turned out that the Corps built this levee 3 to 7 feet higher than it was authorized. So we had that on our blog about 6 weeks before the Post-Dispatch made it a front page story about 2 weeks ago. So I'm kind of proud of that story. And it's a continuing story for us. And it's been a lot of fun for the students to see how the Corps of Engineers and the Valley Park city officials react when you call them up for comment on this particular story. So that's a story that's going to stay with us for a while, and it's rated in the top 10. Also did a story on coal smoke and the coal smoke blog of one of the SEJ members. Do you know who I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. His name is escaping me.
Ken Ward? Cool tattoo?
Yeah, I'm not. But we decided to put his blog and some information about that on the site. And that's been in the top 10 as well because people can relate to that. And the Post-Dispatch loved that story because that's one of their Pulitzers from the past. So we actually got the blog mentioned in the media column within the Post-Dispatch. And of course, we had a bounce in traffic to the site after the Post-Dispatch did that. So those are some of the things that they write about. Here's some runner-ups. And again, I think it shows, you know, the wide interest in the class when you have all these different constituencies. So we have one on Asian carp. I have a student who graduated from our program and got the environmental journalism certificate. She works for the Alton Telegraph now, and she specializes in Asian carp, so she's a great source for us for doing that story. But other stories that are kind of runner-ups, and they're pretty diverse, is hunting mushrooms and morel mushrooms in particular. Disabled vets learning to kayak at the Jefferson Barracks in South County in St. Louis, endangered bats, green spiral tours. That's another one of the new environmental organizations in St. Louis that takes young students on tours of the environment. We also had a student who went on to an environmental newsletter in Washington, D.C., and they sent her to cover the Paris Climate Conference, so we were able to do an interview with her, and we don't have a lot of climate change on the site, but that gave us a chance to do a story on climate change and to get students interested in that as well who are reading the blog. So this is probably not particularly novel. I know that I've attended SEJ conferences on the academic side several different years where professors have talked about their blogs and their WordPress sites, but I really find it interesting from the standpoint of being able to look at what gathers traffic, because we really are in the business of, we don't like to say this, but selling stories, getting people interested. And so to understand what sells stories, I think it's good to have this constituency of the sustainability students, the students who are in strategic communications or public relations, and then the more hardcore journalism students, because I think it gives them an insight to what's out there, what people are interested in reading. And I think that's really the key for this beat to prosper, is to be looking at the audience, not always be looking at what impresses us as writers. So that's kind of my spiel for today.
Okay, good. Let's open it up to not only questions, but also to some of your great strategies that have worked well for you as well. Anybody have a comment?
I had mentioned TommyMedia.com, and several years ago we consolidated the campus television station, the radio station, and the newspaper into one outlet. And so the students are required to produce videos, audio podcasts, as well as text stories and photo slideshows. And it's all, they're paid. We have an advertising staff, a PR staff, and a graphic design staff. It's about 45 to 50 students, and it's out there for all the world to see. And all of those, you know, radio, TV, text, and photo slideshows are vetted by other students. It's completely student-run. There's a four or five faculty advisors that help them out from time to time. But that's the main exposure that they get.
So we have an investigative newsroom. It's run by another faculty member called CU News Corps, and their entire mission is to get the work published in other media. That was something I've talked to David about in the past, is trying to find a balance of helping to fill the void in environmental coverage when we're doing an environmental story, and we'll probably be, we've got plans to collaborate with CU News Corps on fracking stories and also on fire stories that I do. CU News Corps stories have been placed in the Denver Post. The students have done radio stories. They've been on TV. They've basically been all over Colorado media, and the guy who runs it, Jeff Brown, has been really successful at developing relationships with Colorado media to place things. But I also, in that, I think it's important to, because I'm, you know, still kind of an ink and pencil stained wretch who wasn't in, you know, I'm just out of newsrooms in the last few years, is also to consider what's going on in the industry, because I can remember when I was in there and, you know, it's like, oh, well, they're hiring an intern into this, or they're taking student stories, and that means that, you know, I'm not going to get to do this story. And so, you know, I want to make sure that our students feel like they're helping the industry and not hurting the industry when they're putting something out there. And that really requires developing a relationship with the media itself and knowing the editor and you know, building some trust there. I like what you said there too. I think actually we deprive them of a learning experience when we don't have them have to go through the meat grinder of putting something into real media. Because, you know, it's amazing to see how a student responds when they, you know, get edits back and they say, they need this back for me in half an hour. It's like, yeah, too bad. Welcome to the real world.
one of the things you might consider that's been successful for us too is we're an AP member, and I worked for the AP mm-hmm. for years, and my wife does still, is as an AP member, of course, our stories are offered to the AP just like anybody, any other members would be. And Minnesota AP has a weekly, every Sunday they release a member feature. And when we have a really good piece on our site, I'll offer it to the news editor in Minneapolis. And students' work has been picked up that way and reproduced as well. And I found that the AP connection has been very beneficial. They run our photographs, stories, and elsewhere, and it helps them understand how the wire service works. And we've been successful in placing a number of students with the AP because of that.
I really can't add much to that. I know that, you know, in talking to Jacob Barker and Roland Close and some of the other reporters at the Post-Dispatch that are in the environmental beat, they're fighting for space themselves, and so it's just not really a possibility for student work to end up in the daily newspaper there. But the outlets that they do have are with all the different environmental groups that are represented in St. Louis. So those are some good places for them, and they do get published in some of the different newsletters with different environmental advocacy groups.
Well, I don't want to move off that yet, because the reason Michael's on this panel is because he came to me with this very intriguing concept of, are we undermining our profession by having our students be the watchdogs of democracy instead of paying some professional to do that as well? And I'm wondering, do you have similar types of concerns? And you know, Michael, you said you addressed this a little bit by making sure you have strong partnerships and people understand what you're doing, but they're still eating up news hole.
They are, and so, yeah, I think we're right when we think in terms of, you know, if you're dealing with a publication that's got an environment reporter or somebody that is interested in covering these issues and you're taking news hole away from them, that's problematic to have a student going in and you know, basically offering them cheap work to publications that increasingly that's, you know, a big driver. On the other hand, we try to focus on stories that we don't think that the publication we're going to talk to has the resources to do. And so, you know, you guys probably recall a year or so ago, there was a mine spill in Colorado down by Durango, turned the Animas River the color of tang. And so we were able to go down and kind of have a little multimedia team that I managed over a weekend. And we certainly aren't offering those stories to the Denver Post or to places that can do those stories themselves. But there's plenty of other media in Colorado that doesn't have the resource to get down there and do stories on that. And particularly with online media, yeah, well, then you're not really worried so much about Newshole. You know, they've got a pretty big appetite and a lot of space. So a lot of times we're focusing on stories that we don't think other publications have the resource anymore to do or never had the resource to do, but we'd love to do it. I'll point out a couple of things. One is that we're a little different from St. Louis. We have a few environmental disasters, but the advantage of Boulder is we've got 14 federal research labs. We have all kinds of environmental research going on. So there are a lot of science stories and environmental science stories that publications, particularly web-based publications, are interested in, but they don't have somebody that focuses on that or they don't have a relationship with the lab. The other difference between us and St. Louis, you have trouble finding a good environment story in beer, and we do at least one and usually two field trips for our science writing and reporting on the environment students to breweries, because the breweries that we deal with actually have chemists and geneticists that work at them, and so the science of beer is definitely my most popular field trip.
Yeah, I should say that Schlafly's microbrew is kind of like the epicenter of sustainability in St. Louis, and they also have a big auditorium that they have at the brewery, and it's all for green kinds of activities. So they've sort of become sort of a focal point for students to go to, and they like the product too. So.
Yeah, and I just want to add, Nadia White, who was originally slated on this panel, also has a really interesting perspective, and I hate to represent it, but it goes something along the lines of, so the gold standard for us is to get our kids published, and they go through the grinder and they figure out how to do it, and that's really, really wonderful. Well, there are issues, there are real issues in terms of, are we undermining our profession by providing cheap labor for publications that, well, if they don't have the resources, they'll never have the resources. Well, why should they bother to invest in resources? We're giving it away free. We're giving it away very cheaply. That's one angle on it. And the other angle is, as Nadia says, well, really? We're teaching something that kids can learn by freelancing themselves, if they're motivated and that they go out there and they slug it away. Let's use the classroom for something else. Let's use it for really cutting edge, very unusual types of journalism, very experimental, the types of things that universities should be doing, out there. And if we keep, pushing this traditional model of get published, go through the grinder. It's a tough one for me because I'm very much on the side of, you learn by getting published. But it's an interesting.
I mean, are those two things mutually exclusive? Can you be kind of doing a little bit of both?
Yes, sir.
Do any of you teach about phrasing the stories of environmental threats with an eye towards reader retention? I'm asking this question because a large number of the publications about environment, like climate change and other things, when the social scientists get in there, they find out that even if somebody reads it, they repress it because they feel so powerless. And I've been wrestling with how do you lower the repression function?
Well, I think that's, we're talking about how do you grab an audience, because eyes glaze over so much when you're talking about what's really pretty wonky subject. Especially when you're talking about something like remediating a radiation site. So I think students have a better feel for popular culture, and I think when they find a way to adapt a story to a popular culture kind of angle, I think it works. I think that's one of the things that we need to learn from them, because they have a handle on that, and to some extent we don't. So I think your question's a very good one. I think that's one of the reasons why the environmental beat has been in decline, is that we sort of talk to each other and we write for each other, and it's not been working out very well for us.
One of the things that we do, it's not directly related to your question, but it is in a way, is we partly based on our AP contract, we have three different analytical softwares to keep track of who reads the material that we publish, but not only who reads it, but how long they stay with it. In other words, if it's a minute and a half video, did they watch the whole minute and a half? And if they didn't, at what point do they stop? And then where do they go after they stop? And so we have learned a great deal, I think, about attention spans, among other things. But I think we've learned a few things about what either starts to make the audience either bored or too frightened to continue to read or whatever the reason might be when we find a common place where they bail out on us. And some of that information has been very useful for us in terms of how do we present materials down the line. You know, we figure, okay, if it's this kind of story, it needs to be this length. If it's this kind of story, it needs to be structured in this way. If it's this kind of a photo slideshow, they're only going to look at so many slides of a disaster before they stop, that sort of thing. So we've gotten some kind of parameters there.
Can I suggest that maybe next year we do a session based on the learnings from that?
Sure.
So you're in charge of the using analytics for teaching.
I found it to be, I obviously wasn't familiar with it when I started, but we have two that we use, and then one that the AP requires us to use because we have to supply them with audience numbers to justify our contract, and so it was forced on me.
Nancy, last question.
Let me follow up on that briefly. So we don't do anything directly with analytics because we have publications from our journalism program, but not specifically environmental publications. Sometimes, depending on the group of graduate students that want to do things, we do different things. But I have done a lot with analytics and videos elsewhere in the program and elsewhere in the university. And one thing is to use those to respond to counterintuitive things coming out of the business. And so one thing is, you know, I came in kind of pounding the drum about production values and having high standards for the work that we presented. And we've discovered in looking at analytics that at least among young viewers, having really polished videos and really polished audio pieces, like super polished, is a turnoff. Like authenticity. They like shaky camera sometimes. They would rather have a quote that is stumbly and real than something that where somebody's said it over and over and has got it just right. And so you're being able to respond to those things and kind of, okay, I guess I was always wrong, is a good thing, or at least the industry has changed. And then one other thing that I think we're starting to work with and I'm working with some students on is this idea of solutions journalism. I don't know if any of you have followed up on that, but I think one of the problems with teaching this is that people become numb, you know, and they feel as though they can't help, they can't do anything with that. And this solutions journalism movement is, it's not just like making happy stories, but it's a way of writing stories in a way that people feel as though they're engaged, there's some way I can be involved in this, there's some change I can implement. So that's another way that I think that we can increase engagement.
Okay, I'm really sorry about this, but Jay just stuck his head in and gave me the hook. So we got to wind this up here, but I'm sure our panelists will hang around to discuss some of these things. Thanks a lot for your participation. I know I got a notebook full of good ideas. If anybody wants to talk about the Young Emerging Journalist Program, please stop by and talk to me afterwards as well.
Thanks a lot.